The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
I always look about, you know, teams who've won a league, their mindsets, their body language, their hunger, desire. And I see that so much in this Liverpool team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Rory McIlroy's game has changed a lot.
The OTB Brief. Weekday mornings from 7:20 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, you're very welcome back to the show. Happy to say Matt Williams joins us, and we have Brendan Fanning from the Sunday Independent, who has thawed out since last night at Thomond Park. Brendan, I hope?
Yeah, all good, Joe.
So this was decent fare under the circumstances. What were conditions like in person? They didn't look good on TV.
About an hour beforehand, in fact, an hour and a half beforehand, 6 o'clock almost on the dot. You know when the weather forecasters get things absolutely on the nail, it's going to start raining at 6 o'clock, sure enough. Snow and sleet, and it looked absolutely miserable. It was horribly cold and wet. And I said, right, this is the end of this game. It's going to be an absolute disaster. And mercifully, towards the end of the players' warm-up, things started to improve. And by kickoff time, it was okay. And it's a never-ending source of fascination how it can be piddling down for an hour and a half. And within about 15, 20 minutes, players get to grips with just how bad it is. So they did very well. It was very greasy, but luckily, little bit of snow during the game, not much, and no howling gale. Had there been a gale force wind, it would have made it really difficult. So, you know, it was okay. And I thought, I noticed Matt's comment on Twitter saying, I think, what did you say, Matt? It was a crap spectacle or not a good spectacle or something. Maybe I was just so excited about being out of the house and being down the N7 for the first time in a year. I was happy to put up with anything, but I thought it was a really good game. I was absolutely absorbed by it.
Do you want to come in on that, Matt?
Yeah, sure, Joe, Brendan. I thought it was a tough old encounter. It's a typical Munster Leinster. I thought there was way too much kicking. I don't blame the teams for that. I think that's the way rugby's going. I saw a stat. Now, I can't guarantee these stats because they're not my own, but both teams had close to 700 metres in kicking, which is a lot of kicking. They're always tough games. And they're games you've got to win. You've got to give Leinster and Munster a lot of credit because it was certainly physical. You know, the numbers, again, was 378 tackles in that game. Leinster 195, Munster 183. That's a staggering number of collisions. But obviously, you know, snow is frozen rain. It makes it when it hits the ground, it wasn't sticking. It was the ball was wet and slippery, and they had trouble getting it through the pass through the hands. But a tough game. But for Leinster, in the shortened format of the season that's right now is still what the Pro 12 are saying, it was a huge, huge win to beat Munster at Thurman for the first time. Munster have lost there in 4 years, I believe. That was some effort. And there'll be some very sore and bruised bodies today with 378 tackles happening in 80 minutes. That's a lot of defence.
Mm. I thought it was a good watch as well, and I wasn't, like Brendan, delirious to be out of the house. I was on the safety of my couch. You found it tough going, did you, Matt?
I did, mate. I got to say I'm finding rugby in general at the moment. Generally speaking, there's more games like that than there are games where you get up and you go, wow, that was fabulous. I watched some top 14 the last few weeks and, you know, a little bit of the pro 12 of some of the games that are coming back, and there's just so much kicking. Defensive lines are so fast coming off the line, penalty after penalty. I'm finding it. I must say, it's not the game I was brought up on, or the game that I the style of rugby that I love. There was no doubt it was very dramatic and hard and grinding, and there was a lot in that for it. There's a lot to be said for that. But the rugby itself, I think at the moment, has a lot to be desired.
Okay. So Munster came out of the traps, Brendan. For people who didn't see this game, Munster 10, Leinster 13, two tries, one apiece. Jordan Larmour stealing it felt like a little bit at the death because Munster had led for so much of the game. 12 minutes gone, they had 10 points on the clock. That was as good as it got for them from a scoreboard point of view. But first 15, 20 minutes, Leinster barely touched the ball, it felt like.
Yeah, I was really impressed by Munster's opening. Not just the momentum they generate, but how clever they were. If you go back to the build-up to their first try, they got a penalty. They didn't get into touch. Leinster are bracing themselves for the maul. So decided, okay, we're not going to contest this. Everyone on the ground got to stop this maul at source before it gets going. Maul never got going because they took it straight off the top of O'Mahony. Conor Murray immediately gets on the front foot and makes the handiest 10 or 12 metres he's ever made in his life. Munster goes straight into phase play, hammer the living daylights out of Leinster over five, six, seven phases close to their line. And then O'Mahony does really well to assist Tadhg Byrne in getting over the line. And everything about it looked clinical and planned and well thought out. And I said, OK, suddenly 10-0, Leinster in trouble. And Leinster got into it then. And then one of the big keys in the show was towards the end of the half, Munster represented with a long-range penalty in a pretty similar position to one that JJ Hanrahan had nailed to give them the lead in the first place. Has another go, hits the post. Time is up now at this stage almost. Ball comes down. Munster would have been hoping Leinster put the ball out of play. Let's go in. 10-3. Not bad. Suddenly, Rhys Marshall, you know, an absolute quality player, one of the most skillful hookers on the island, I would say. And he makes a no-arms tackle, which was just daft. Suddenly, penalty. Leinster say, well, hang on a second. You know, we'll crack on with this for a while. They're back up the other end of the field a couple of minutes later. Sexton is kicking a penalty. And what should have been 10-3, maybe 13-3 to Munster, suddenly becomes 10-6. And you could feel the element of doubt coming into Munster's mind. And in that kind of situation, Leinster skipped into the dressing room saying, grand, we're back in this, lads. Let's get after it. And they did.
Yes. Matt, I thought of you. Championship minutes, that halftime moment felt big.
It was without doubt the turning point of the game for me. I agree with Brendan. It just shows you the self-belief that a team like Leinster has. When the ball hit the upright, I just thought, kick it out, get it down the other end of the field. And they believed in themselves. They didn't worry about what the clock said. They believed they had some points in them. And I think when they ran in, it was 43 minutes and something. It might have even been 44, but it was certainly a long haul after the 40-minute mark. And that changed the game for them. The one thing I would say, both teams had done their homework. I think it was interesting, the crossfield kicks that Leinster didn't execute very well yesterday. They usually are spot on. Johnny Sexton put one out and Gary Ringrose put one out in the full, both of them. But they had the theory that I have, and that's pretty much going around the rugby world, that you get the ball in behind that line of Munster, and it's a very good defensive line that Munster have. But if you can get the ball in behind it, that they don't like it, and there's lots of space and there's lots of opportunity. And, of course, that ended up being the absolute undoing of Munster in the end when Ross Byrne came on and did what's got to be said was an absolutely glorious kick. He had a bend in it, so it came on to Keenan. He passed out beautifully to Lama, whose footwork all night was top shelf. His hands weren't, but his footwork was. Yeah. And you had Gibson Park running a brilliant line that we might – anyone watching the NFL tonight from America would be very happy at. He ran a blocking line on the inside to stop the defence. And the game, unbelievably, was Leinster's because Munster – for the majority of that game with a better team. But again, that kick in behind Munster, which has been their Achilles heel on so many occasions in big games over the last few years, came out again.
And is there any particular reason Munster are especially susceptible to that kick, Matt?
Look, I'm very critical of the copycat coaching that goes on right across the globe here. And everyone's putting there's 14 players in the front line, and one in behind, and once you get down to your 22, it's impossible for one defender behind the line to cover the area that they're asking him to cover. And if you think back to when Rassing went to thumb in there a couple of, I think it was last year. You know, Teddy Thoma, just the chip over the top. And really since the Bordeaux game 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the big teams against Munster are putting the ball in behind them. They move it to the extremities, then put the ball in behind, and there just isn't the cover there. Finn Russell scored a great try doing exactly that down there as well. And they've got to change. When you come to your 22, in my opinion, when you're defending in your 22, you need to change your structure a bit. And unfortunately, Munster and a number of the other clubs aren't. And that's why we're seeing so many kicks that are scoring tries now, and the players are getting so much better at their short kicking game. It's so accurate and so controlled. We'll see a lot more.
JJ Hanrahan missed another kick then at the start of the second half, Brendan, and it was a far more kickable one. It's probably the unforgivable one in the nature of the game, especially when you look at the final scoreline and a difference of 3 points. And then it toed and froed a little bit, and Leinster sprung from nowhere with that brilliant try, as Matt says. So you kind of came away with a sense that Munster are developing and are growing and are closing the gap somewhat on Leinster. But whatever phrase you want to use, be it ruthlessness or a kind of killing edge, they're still searching for that. You know, even the way they almost gifted the game to Connacht a couple of weeks ago, they're not getting as much bang for their buck as more ruthless teams do.
What they got away with in the sports ground, they didn't get away with last night. It's funny, I was thinking about it on the drive to the snow coming back up the M7 last night, and how would Johan van Graan deal with this? And it probably doesn't help that he's not brilliant English. He's not a charismatic communicator. And I think Munster are in a pretty tight spot here now at the moment, because they had all this momentum. They had Leinster by the throat. They made a mess of it. And the way they made a mess of it, some of the mistakes that they made, you said that you referred to Leinster's try there at the end. Matt picked up on the line that Jameson Gibson-Park ran. It's worth noting that Gibson-Park was on the wing. That Leinster took a gamble on a 6-2 selection. They got away with it. Gibson-Park comes on. They call that strike play at the end, even though he's a scrum half. And I wonder, Matt maybe might have an opinion on this, I wonder had he ever run that line in training. I wonder when they're doing their what-if scenarios, do they mix lads up and put them in different positions and get them to run these lines? Because he ran it absolutely perfectly. Could have been any better. But go back and ask yourself why Leinster were in that position in the first place. A couple of minutes earlier, Conor Murray had kicked well in behind Gibson-Park, and I thought they would subject him to the kind of aerial abuse that they had visited on Larmour in the first half. Anyway, they get the ball in behind him. They fail to stop a Leinster drive from that line out of the Leinster 22. They defend it really badly on the short side. Suddenly, Luke McGrath saying, I can't believe this, we're away. And that's what completely transformed it. And once Leinster got back down into Munster territory, you could just see it like this. You knew they were going to finish the job. They got the call right. They rode their luck. I think it was James Ryan got the ball, the line-out throw at the back of the line-out. I think he was pretty much facing his own sticks, Joe, when he got it. And it was let go. I'd say that's driving Munster insane. But in any case, when Munster review that, first question they need to ask themselves is, why were we 30, 35 metres from our own sticks when we had started by turning them, by putting the ball in behind them and putting pressure on them? Somehow we end up 30 metres from our own line in the manure business. And then Keenan, like, I thought it was his contribution in that sequence was absolute class.
Yes, there's a few individuals we'll have to discuss in light of the Six Nations coming, and he'll be one of them. Matt, to pick up on where Brendan's going with those points, when you look at Munster as a coach and a sense of how teams progress, like would you argue they're still in a good place and that they are improving, and those points Brendan brings up, they're the finishing touches as a side becomes a winning side, or are these pretty fundamental problems?
Look, I think Munster are making progress. No, I definitely do think they're making progress. But in some key positions, they just haven't got the personnel. JJ Hanrahan tries his heart out. I really admire the young man. But he, you know, I've just got to say it, you can't miss that. The kick just before halftime was a long range, and the second one wasn't. And you can't not score against Leinster for 68 minutes. So they were 10-0 after 12 minutes. They didn't score another point. Mm. You just got, you know, like, let's call a spade a spade. You're not going to beat one of the best teams in Europe if you can't score points for that long in the game against anyone. Racing, you know, if you get up the top end of Europe where Munster aspire to be, you're playing Racing, Toulouse, Exeter, you know, that's just not going to be enough to do it. And that's what I mean. And they didn't have anyone on their bench that could really come on and turn a game. I thought Ross Byrne last night changed the game when he came on. I thought he played really well. I didn't think Johnny had one of his better games, but he wasn't disastrous. He never is. He's a high-quality player. But that kick from Ross Byrne turned the game. Now, a kick is only as good as his chase, as Brendan pointed out. I thought it was a glorious chase from Kernan. His hands were just spectacular. But Munster don't seem to have those match winners right now. They certainly, you know, even their centres, they're quality players. I'm not talking them down. But there's no one with a spark that seems to be able to take a game by the throat and move it around. Now, you can see what the coaches are doing. You can see what Stephen Larkham's trying to do. It was very hard last night with, as Brendan said, the weather conditions and sitting snow before the game. But you can see what Stephen Larkham is trying to do with that team. And some of the players I've seen him play back at when he was playing for the Brumbies and I was coaching against him 20 years ago, and they're bringing them out and they're highly effective. So they are making progress. But there's also a reality. The top end, the very, very top end, it's hard. And they're not quite there yet. Mm. And they're probably not going to be there until they can lift the level of the skill of key personnel. And I'm not sure how they're going to do that, to be really honest. Joey Carberry returning, well, let's wait and see. That's obviously one. But they need someone that's got some more X factor than they've got there at the moment.
Okay. With a view to Six Nations coming up then, Brendan, Jordan Larmour's name has popped up a few times here. Scores the winning try. And I mean, what's never in doubt with him is what he can do with the ball in his hand. And there was a moment in the first half when a bit of loose play developed and he danced around a few people and Keith Earls did very well, I think, ultimately to snuff out that opportunity. And yet, if you think back to November 18 against Argentina, fullback for Ireland, teams would have come away from that game saying, well, there's a weakness there under the high ball. And here we are in 2021. And I think there were four times under the high ball yesterday where there was a weakness exposed and Conor Murray probably knew all about it. He's going to have to clean that up somehow pretty quickly.
He is. If I can just go back to something, if you don't mind, Joe.
Sure.
You started that whole sequence with JJ and... But I mentioned Johan van Graan. I think van Graan has a very difficult decision to make now in the continued absence of Joey Carberry. Is he going to continue with JJ as his first choice 10? Because Ben Healy looked very good when he came on. And Jack Crowley, who eventually made his debut a couple of weeks ago, is another lad with lots of promise. And there is a bit of a flaw in JJ's game. And I think he really needs to, he has a tough decision there to figure out at, in the absence, as I say, in the absence of Carberry. To go back to Larmour, what really impressed me about Larmour last night was that he was so good with ball in hand, despite the fact that stuff in the air was going so badly. Mm. I don't know if you picked up on it at home on the TV, the noise level that Munster were generating when they were getting a return out of those box kicks from Murray. So they would, Larmour would spill it. And they're like, it's so difficult. It's such a difficult skill in good conditions. In crap conditions, it's even harder. And sometimes the escorts, as they're called, didn't do a brilliant job and exposed him a wee bit. There was one instance in particular where Earls did really, really well just to insinuate himself in between a couple of blue shirts. And Larmour just said, OK, I've got this. And the next thing, Earls is standing underneath him and it just goes, you know, arseways. So I admired his mental fortitude for being so good when the opportunities came, despite the fact that things were going so badly. He's not a big bloke. I mean, he has enormous power for a man of his size, and he's got fantastic footwork, and he's got really good speed, and he hasn't got a bad kicking game either. but I don't see how they're going to turn him into a 6'2". That ain't going to happen. So yeah, they're going to have to work really, really hard on his aerial game, because as long as that continues, then he's going to attract trouble.
Yeah, do you want to come in, Matt?
Yeah, it's just right down here, you know, for Ireland. Lama, Stockdale, Earls and Keenan, you know, 4 in 3 don't go. So, but I actually think Keenan has got the 15 jersey. I didn't think Stockdale was anywhere near the quality at 15 required at international level. I think he's a winger. And I think Leo's saying the same thing in his selection. So therefore, you know, Keith Earls has been the stalwart. Which one misses out? Because there's really, that we've got a number of good wingers, Conway as well, obviously we could throw into that mix, but there's no one really standing out as a top quality replacement to Robbie Carney at the moment. I would have said Jordan Lama, and Joe, you've heard me say that many times, and he's just making too many mistakes, but so Stockdale. So it's an interesting dilemma the coaches, the selectors for the national team will have on who they put in there. But there's one thing Lama's got. He's got an X factor. He has got the best feet in Ireland. And just for that alone, his ability to beat a player, you put him in a space, no one stops him. And he'll often beat the first chaser if he's got a little bit of time. So I would still select him for Ireland, but I take on board everything Brendan said. He's going to get – you imagine what England are going to do to him. You know, he's just going to get rained. But so would Stockdale, and so will Stockdale. It's right now, you've got to say, there's a chink in Irish armour behind that line.
Mm. And so Keenan then has really, you know, like you don't remember people saying, God, you've got to see this guy when he comes through and he's electric and he's got all these tools. But he's just blossomed very steadily, but very surely, Matt, into, it seems now, the starting 15 for Ireland.
Well, I'm a convert, I've got to say. I was unsure. I had some of the old Leinster players I coached sing his praises to me, and I was umming and ahhing. But he's just one of the things you've got to have as a fullback is a lack of errors. Sometimes, you know, and you, without anything but showing respect to Robbie Carney just didn't make mistakes. You go back through who's had the 15 jerseys, you know, Gervie Dempsey just did not make mistakes. And you can't have the old term they used to use for fullback, custodian, the guy behind you dropping the ball. You just can't have that. He's got to be able to catch and kick. That's 101. And he's doing that. His game is error-free. Now, to follow on Brendan's point, he's not the tallest dude out there, but he's got great feet. He can sniff out a try. But what I like about him is his error rate is very low. And compared to Jordan and Jacob, when they've been given that 15 jersey, they've made too many errors at this point. So I certainly think he's earned his shot at the title.
Okay. So, Brendan, for all the electricity of a Larmer and a Stockdale, no mistakes is point number one required.
There was a classic coaching monologue. First thing you want to do is cut down on your errors, and then let's build from there. And there is nothing worse than rugby. The ball goes over your head and you're saying, Jesus, is he going to deal with this? Because if players feel that the number 15 is not going to deal with it, then they deal with everything themselves a little less well. Keenan reminds me of one of those guys from an old-fashioned tour where you go away and you play, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 games on tour, and there's a midweek side and a Saturday side, and he's like a guy from the midweek side who gets into the Saturday side and just gets better and better and better. Mm. Every time I see Keenan, he just keeps getting better, and he's very vocal, very good at claiming balls, very good at barking instructions at people in front of him, even though he's relatively new to the setup. So yeah, it was the first thing I put into the report last night. Like, he's nailed. Andy Farrell was there. Himself and Paul O'Connell were sitting down a few rows in front of us. And I said, that's one question answered for Farrell. That's his 15 slot sorted.
Okay. Meanwhile, if there's a turnover on the ground now and it's not Tadhg Byrne, I think it's a surprise. So what does this fella, Brendan, have to do to get into match day 23? And I mean, maybe even more particularly into a starting jersey?
I don't know. It is unfortunate for him that he's competing. He is not your prototype test second row. He's not a killer size for test level second row.
What height? What height is he?
He's about 6'4", 6'5", but he's not a brute.
Okay.
Like he's a absolute dream size six, and he's the athleticism for a six. And if you free him up from the grunt of second row, and you give him that latitude to show up in a posting capacity at more breakdowns, then he's going to do untold damage. He's also got really good hands. He has it all going on. Like, if you go back to the Scarlets, when the Scarlets won the Pro 12, Pro 14 title a few years ago, he was absolutely central to that. The number of balls that he stole for them that year, and not just going backwards. You know, he's a very good link player going forward, and we saw that again last night. The unfortunate bit for him is that he's if you want to put him in his best position of six, then he's going up against Peter O'Mahony, who carries a lot of weight off the field as well as on the field. I don't mean physically. And, you know, Paul O'Connell wants to fix the Ireland line out. I suspect Peter O'Mahony is a player he's going to want on the field to help that. Now, maybe they move O'Mahony across to seven, but I would just love to see Tyburn start a game at six and not come off the bench.
Mm. Matt?
I agree with Brennan. He's a six at international level, without doubt, and a very good six. Gee, it's competitive back row, isn't it? Because I'm going to get shot down here, but Reece Ruddock has just been outstanding since rugby's returned. He has been outstanding. Now, people say he can't take the step up every time he's been given the opportunity. He hasn't taken it. He's been outstanding. I thought Peter O'Mahony should have been dropped last year, and I've got to say Peter has come back and played some sensational rugby as well. Will Connors, you know, Doris has probably got the eight sewn up. He might even be a Lion. There's just so many quality players there, which is great for Ireland. How do you fit them in? Well, you can't. But I think something that this Irish coaching staff haven't figured out, and I'll give them some leeway because it is a very, very hard conundrum. It's a dilemma. Is they haven't got a back row on the field that is really well balanced, like the England back row. They haven't got the three separate pieces. Sometimes they put out players that are too similar. You know, as I say, my old coach used to say, the back row is a sandwich. It's all layers. And the combination of them makes them special. Now, if Doris is eight, which I think he is, then you've got to pick a seven and six around that. And that can't be CJ and Peter because they're all too similar. That's my opinion anyway. So it's a very, very big dilemma. And therefore, does Byrne get into that start? To me, he's a perfect bench player because he covers so many positions. Mm. Because, and this is a problem for him, he's not playing six for his province. He's playing second row. So it's very hard to compare him with the other sixes running around who every week are getting that opportunity. So he's certainly being hampered by not starting in the back row for Munster. And, you know, there's good, strong competition in the second row. You know, Ryan's got one spot for sure. Where does Henderson go? There's a few other young guys coming through. So he's a positive for Ireland is it's so competitive, but I would still have him on my bench, and a very, very good bench player that could make a big difference when he comes on.
Mm. Just one last point out of last night, Brendan. Conor Murray, like the subject of so much scrutiny over the last 2 years, he looks to be really back in a good place again to my eye. What was he like there in person?
Yeah, I thought he was good. His kicking was absolutely on the money. And conditions for kicking as well as fielding were pretty difficult. Yeah, I was impressed with him, and Farrell loves him. So Matt made the point that he reckoned Peter O'Mahony should have been dropped last year. I agree with him 100%. I also think Murray should have gone earlier and Cooney should have come in, and that ship has sailed now. So Murray has weathered that storm and is rock solid. He's nailed on there. And as I say, Farrell really likes him, but Murray's the type of player that appeals to Farrell.
Mm. Where is Murray, Matt, in comparison with his very best stuff?
Connor's come back a long way. Connor was the best box kicking nine in the world currently. It's probably only the second. There's only one I've seen better. That was a guy called Aru, who played for Transvaal in South Africa in the 95 World Cup. He was an unbelievable kicker from scrum half. He could torpedo 60 metres down the field from behind a ruck. And Connor, I would coach kids how to box kick, and I just give them Connor Murray. I give him a put on the phone, say, slow it down, watch tape, just paint by numbers. That's how Connor Murray does it. That's how you're going to do it. And for some reason that I cannot tell you why, when he hurt his neck, his technique abandoned him. And he couldn't kick a ball there for 18 months. He was terrible. And I felt so sorry for him because he was with Aaron Smith there with New Zealand. He was the top, they were the top two scrum halves in the world for a long time. And the neck injury had just affected Connor so much. And he became slow and at the breakdown with Munster's ball was just so slow and Irish ball was so slow. It has speeded up. He has speeded that up. His kicking game, as Brennan said, has returned and he is playing much better rugby. He's not back to where he was. He's still a little bit slower, but that's age. That gets us all. Mm. But he's certainly playing much, much better than he was at the end of Joe Schmidt's time and at the beginning of Farrell's time. And Ireland will have to do that. Ireland can't play like England. They just don't have – it doesn't suit them. They don't have the players. They've got to play a much faster game. So they can't have a nine that slows – that turns fastball into slow ball. And that's what Connor was doing. I don't think he meant to do it. He was just doubting himself and doubting his players outside him, where now I think he's used to the coaching that he's getting. He's used to the attacking system. He's probably got getting better communication, so he's getting that ball away a bit faster and he's got his belief back in his kick. And that's all healthy for Ireland. I think he's definitely the starting nine. There's no one else, to be honest. There's no one near him at the moment.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break. It's Matt Williams and Brendan Fanning with us. We'll preview Six Nations, a couple of more players from last night, I'm sure, will be part of that discussion. And it's historic Six Nations in some respects because it's probably the last free-to-air one of our lifetimes. So we'll talk about that in just a moment as well. Now, you're very welcome back. Connacht, by the way, in action against Ospreys have just taken the lead, 10 points to 5. It was Marmion who forced a knock-on as Ospreys attacked just outside the 22, ball popped up for Fitzgerald, had Wooten in support, and then gave it to Alex Wooten, and he scored the try. Fitzgerald converted, so Connacht 10, Ospreys 5, about 34 minutes on the clock in the Pro 14. We're here with Brendan Fanning from the Sunday Independent, Matt Williams with us as well. Just a point before we get your overall thoughts ahead of the 2021 Six Nations is that this is probably the last free-to-air Six Nations, it would appear, and no inside knowledge whatsoever. But it certainly looks that way, of our lifetimes, or certainly for the foreseeable. And to declare an interest, obviously Matt and I work in Virgin Media's coverage, and hell, we'd happily take the next 20 years doing it on Virgin Media. Why not? But ultimately, that's not the point here. Because Paul Rouse wrote about it during the week, and I think he made some really interesting salient points. Paul Rouse is a professor of history at UCD, a regular on the show. CDC have bought 14.5%, or they're about to. 14.5% share of Six Nations commercial rights. And so all the indicators are that the easy way to get short-term money, not least in COVID times, is to put Six Nations behind a paywall. So the point Paul Rouse makes in his Irish Examiner piece, which you'll get online, is that this protected list in Ireland really started in 2003. You might remember Republic of Ireland games suddenly pitched up behind a paywall on Sky Sports and there was uproar and Simon Coveney and others were giving out about it. So it was thought, well, we need to get a protected list here and put it into legislation. So in 2003, after that Republic of Ireland game on Sky situation, the Olympics went on the protected list, All-Ireland Senior Football and Hurling Finals, Republic of Ireland World Cup and European matches, the World Cup, the Euros, Ireland matches in the Rugby World Cup are on the list, the Irish Grand National, the Irish Derby, the Dublin Horse Show. That was the gist of the list in 2003. Paul Rouse says in his piece, the contrast in the manner in which rugby was treated in comparison with soccer is obvious and wrong. Now, in 2010, Eamon Ryan, Minister for Communications, tried to right that wrong, if you agree it's a wrong, and he wanted to add new events to the list. These included Six Nations rugby to go on the list, Heineken Cup matches involving Irish provincial teams, GAA provincial finals and quarterfinals and semi-finals in both football and hurling, and Cheltenham, I think, as well. And there was a big furore. Ultimately, that was the Green Party Fianna Fáil government as the country was going down the toilet. So there were other bigger issues at play and the government fell. And I don't remember this discussion being picked up by any communications minister since. Brendan, I 2010, I remember this was not a straightforward thing for Eamon Ryan, and there was an impressive counterattack, as Paul Rouse framed it in his piece in The Examiner, which the RFU were very much a part of. In effect, was there a degree of knocking on Eamon Ryan's door and saying, if you do this financially, you're screwing us in a big way here?
They weren't knocking on his door, Joe. They were kicking his door in. the reason the A-list didn't have rugby on it was because the IRFU lobbied very effectively over the years to make sure that it didn't get on the A-list, because they wanted to some degree to be masters of their own destiny. Now, obviously, they were going to be affected by outside sources, their colleagues in the Five Nations and then the Six Nations when it became that. So the last thing that they wanted was to continue being, as they would have seen it, lowballed by RTE at the time. And they wanted to have some measure of control over the product and to generate more cash from it. And interestingly, it has stayed, even though it is not A-listed, it's B-listed. We still have, there is still an acknowledgement, not just in the IRFU, but in the other unions as well, that free-to-air makes sense. And free-to-air does make sense. If you're trying to sell something, it makes absolute sense that you will put it in front of as wide an audience as possible. And as soon as you go pay-per-view or satellite, clearly you are dwarfing your figures. You're just jumping off the edge of the cliff in return for getting a fat wedge. And what you do with that money then becomes key. Also, what's interesting in this, Joe, and I haven't seen explored to any great degree, is to what extent rugby has suffered in numbers, playing numbers, by getting into bed with satellites. I remember Derek McGrath was the CEO of ERC, as it was then. It was the precursor of EPCR when they got into bed with Sky, and there was it was a big deal at the time. We were all writing about it, and there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And he was kind of saying, oh, it's all about getting the balance right, getting the money in, yada, yada. We as in Ireland, had fantastic success through that competition, through Munster and Leinster specifically, and also to a degree Ulster. The numbers, while a lot fewer people were watching rugby, because you had to go to your pub or your club if you didn't have a subscription, rugby didn't become an unpopular sport. Lots of people didn't fall off the wagon because the wagon wasn't attracting enough eyeballs. So it is one of it's a topic. It's a bit like VAT on books in the old days. It's a hardly annual, if not annual, it comes up every few years. And Paul referred in his piece to the minister looking at it. The tail end of his piece had a sting in it, like the minister is now looking at this and we'll see which way she goes. I think that happens every 3 years. And it would be a monumental shift if she was to decide that it should be A-listed.
And Matt, I'll bring you in a second, but I suppose the worry here for Brendan, for rugby, Brendan, is that such is the popularity of the Six Nations. You know, the last game we had on TV was the French game, which basically had a million people watching. The worry might be that a million people watching those Irish matches dotted across the year means it can withstand handing over Leinster and Munster to behind the paywall. But actually, this is now the first time where, in effect, in a non World Cup year, Pro 14, it's on TG Car, I should stress, but it's behind a paywall. Six Nations behind a paywall. Champions Cup and BT, very few people in Ireland have it. You're now going to the point where there might be 2, 3, 4 Test matches in autumn left. So it's, can it withstand that? I agree it withstood the Heineken Cup paywall change.
Yeah, you're right. That is the challenge. And what I found probably most interesting about this whole topic is that the article pointed out that when you go behind the paywall, you're attracting a different audience and you're excluding a specific audience. And part of the problem of Ireland's system, and this is parochial, part of the problem of our system is that while we have very functional schools, it is like the system in Matt's home country in Australia, it is essentially a private school preoccupation. Now, ours is highly functional and we produce lots and lots not massive amounts, but we produce a good number of functional players who slot into that system very well. and we punch above our weight. How many are we losing in that mix? Loads. If you take it behind a paywall, you are, I would fear, making that changeover even worse. Our chances of getting those new lads in are even less if you go behind a paywall.
Yeah, Paul Rouse compared the Heineken Cup Leinster in the quarterfinal stages in 07 versus 06. And so when it was on RTE in 06, 255,000 people watched. When it was on Sky in 07, 47,000 watched. So nobody will be surprised at the extent of that drop. But on your point about certain parts of the country being excessively affected, one that jumped out to me was the number of people in rural areas who watched in 06, 111,000, whereas Sky in 07, that dropped to just 9,000. And that was a, you know, particularly big drop. Matt, Australia's been down this route.
The article that that was quite brilliant, Paul wrote, it was as if he was getting the exact history of what's occurred in Australian rugby. Rugby went professional in Australia in 96, went to Sky's equivalent or owner in Australia, which is Fox Murdoch, and it's come out this year. If you had have said to me that rugby in Australia could drop to the level it is at the moment of participation, a drop in participation numbers, drop in people going to games, drop in people watching on TV, it is at levels now that are just purely unbelievable. They've signed a deal this year to get it in Australian rugby, that is, to get it back on free-to-air. Now, there's a lot of troubles with Australian rugby. This is not the only one, but it is without doubt a major, major factor. And it's exactly what Brendan was pointing to. You know, the head of the Jesuits, Leola, you know, he said, give me the boy and I'll have the man. Mm. You know, the sport depends on, sports like rugby, depend on kids falling in love with a sport and then following it through life. That's just the way it is. And pretty much you talk to every player in the game, man or woman, and they fall in love with it at a certain point, usually when they are very, very young. Now, that is usually on TV, you watch it, or you're lucky enough your parents take you along to the games, you get to see some of it, but you are fascinated by it. Now, if you can't see it, if you can't watch this game and fall in love with it, that has a huge impact in future years. Now, that's exactly what's happened in Australian rugby. The numbers of in the male game of 15-a-side male game in Sydney have been absolutely devastated. It is more than 50% down. They are getting no one to go to the game because no one wants to go to the game because it's this self-perpetuating loop. Now, once you put a private equity firm involved in a sport, they do not give a rat's ass about the sport. They give a rat's ass about making money. That's their gig. They're trying to make money. In the short term, you put any sport behind a paywall, it makes money. In the end, rugby in Australia, when the Waratahs were playing, they were getting less than 15,000 people watching them on TV. Now, when I coached the Waratahs, we were averaging 25,000 at a game. That means some weeks you got 35, some weeks you get 18. Last year, they averaged 8. Like, and so much of that can be put down to rugby being behind a paywall. It will take another 20 years in Australia to regenerate. The quality of players coming through, the numbers, all that, it just has been smashed. So if the IRFU or the people running rugby think that this iconic competition, that a national treasure, that is the Six Nations, cannot be smashed and broken and that the game itself can lose hemorrhage numbers, it can. Now, it won't happen in 1 year, but it can happen in a decade. And they only have to look at what Australian rugby was. They were a great rugby nation, and to what they are today. And they are, Australian rugby is on its knees. Now, it's fighting because the community has got back behind it. And I'll finish on this one. Mm-hmm. What people forget is rugby is not like football. It is a community sport. Its basis is the clubs, the AIL clubs. You know, I know Brendan is a Clontarf man to his bootlaces, but that's what rugby around the world is. It is a community that comes in. It's very, very unusual. They don't have millions of fans. Most of the people have had some sort of long-term relationship with the sport, or their family have. And if you break that nexus between a community sport, getting people to play and coming to games and watching the games, it takes forever to return because they're not fans. They're part of the community. And once you lose that community, it's very, very hard to get back. You put it behind a paywall and that community is really threatened.
Yeah, it's a high-stakes gamble. So we're about to find out the cost in 10, 20 years' time of a million people not watching the Sexton drop goal. How many of them are kids? Or, you know, for my age, it was, you know, the O'Driscoll hat-trick. That's the kind of one that hooks you into the possibilities for the sport. Brendan, it sounds like, I don't know what you're hearing, but it sounds like this is fairly inevitable, the paywall.
I'm not altogether sure it is, Joe. I was coasting along thinking, here comes CBC, we're doomed. You know, there'll be a big wedge, but they will get maximum bang for their buck and they'll be gone in 4 or 5 years and rugby will be in a worse place. And I get what CBC and private equity is all about. It is about getting as much money as you can in the allotted time and then throwing your leg over the horse and going. And it doesn't, don't look over your shoulder. Whatever is back there is back there. But they are, and I would love, and I don't, I wish I had the insight that I could give you on this, and I don't. I would love to know the degree to which the other six unions, cowered, bent over, got into the court and said, yeah, in you come, lads. We'll cheerfully take your money. You can have our competition and do with it. Or are they talking the talk and saying, we had a six-team competition, now with you on board at the commercial end of things, we now have a 17 competition, seven-partner competition, which is not to say that you own the competition and you can do what you want. So the unions have got to stand up. And the people who run rugby unions, love them or loathe them, most of them come from a rugby background. Mm. They understand it. They get it. The stuff that Matt was talking about community. And they also understand the basic, that if you have something and you want to sell it, you need people to get a look at it. So they have to be really tuned in to the risks of taking the whole thing lock, stock and barrel off free to air. The other thing is I would love, and I don't know if the Aussies have, if anyone in Australia has done the study on this, and not just get consultants in and the consultants say, what would you like us to find? I would love to know, has an empirical study been done anywhere in the world where this issue has cropped up to show this is the effect? There is a direct correlation between taking it behind a paywall and 50% of your players saying, you know what, I can't see it, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, well, you'd hope the unions are doing that currently. Fellas, the clock is right against us. We didn't even get to preview the Six Nations after all that, but there's plenty of time to do it. Matt Williams, thanks so much as ever. Matt, Brendan Fanning from the Sunday Independent. Pleasure, gents. Thank you.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.